Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine for the performing arts here in the Bay Area. During this hour, I'll be talking with virtuoso organist showman Cameron Carpenter, who performs at SF Jazz these next several days on his digital custom-built international touring organ. I'll talk with acclaimed Indian actress, theater director, and television and film artist Lilette Dubé, who is in the Bay Area as director of Gauhar, a play about the life and times of Indian singer and dancer Gauhar Jaan, one of the first women artists to record music in India. I'll also talk with upcoming actor and performer Will Rowland, who is in town for his debut concert, Loser Songs, from Bay Area Cabaret up at the Fairmont Hotel in the Venetian Room this weekend. Stay with us. That's the voice of Gauhar Jaan, the subject of a play at Enact Arts this weekend. Vinita Sud Belani, artistic director of Enact Arts, joined me last month to talk about their production of The Parting, a multimedia production which detailed the division of India into Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh through personal stories. She'll be directing an Enact production in May called My Fair Dude, but today she's returned with actress and Indian superstar Lilette Dubé, who is directing the current production of Gauhar, which traces the story of one of India's first mass media superstars at the turn of the last century. Although Miss Dubé has appeared in dozens of films, American audiences may recognize her from her roles in 2011's The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, and later the second best exotic marigold hotel in 2015. She was also seen in Monsoon Wedding and recently appeared in Aksar 2, an Indian thriller film. She's directed a number of plays, most notably being Mahesh Dattani's Dance Like a Man, which is the longest-running Indian play in English, having completed 497 shows across the world, including a two-week run on Broadway. In addition to directing Gauhar, she will be giving a free talk this afternoon at 5 at the Institute for South Asian Studies at UC Berkeley. Lilette Dubé, welcome to Open Air.
My God, that was quite an introduction.
And of course, welcome back to you, Vinita. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. This has become my second home. I'm loving it.
Well, we heard a little snippet of Gauhar's voice earlier. We'll hear more in a moment. But was that a voice that was familiar to you in your life's soundtrack growing up in Bombay, now Kolkata, as she was born and raised in Bombay as well?
Well, firstly, it was a lovely introduction to the program because it really took me there, took anyone who's listening there. It isn't Gauhar's voice in its original avatar because those are very scratchy recordings. They were done in 1902. In a very primitive way. So, actually, I just discovered her. I was very, I was looking to do something with music. And I'd studied Indian classical music when I was very young, and I'm very fond of it. So, I was looking for something, and there was a gentleman called Vikram Sampath who's done enormous research for 5 years and written a book called My Name is Gauhar Jaan. And why it's called My Name is Gauhar Jaan is because when she finished her recordings, she wanted everyone to know that it was her who'd sung. So she would squeeze, and it was quite a task because Indian classical music takes an hour, hour and a half for the whole rag. And she had to do it in 2.5 minutes. So she said, okay, show me the money. I'll do it. And she was paid 3,000 rupees in 1902, which is like, I don't know how many thousands of dollars in today's money. So she did that. And in that, she also squeezed in at the end, my name is Gauhar Jaan, very quickly. So she became a superstar because the other people weren't known, but she was known because she said, my name is Gauhar Jaan.
Interesting.
And she was on, you know, on matchboxes, on postcards, all over Europe. Because she was the first woman to record on a vinyl record in 1902.
There
was
an opera. Remember, a 78, for those that even can think of a 78 these days.
It wasn't even a 78. It was a very primitive wax record.
A wax cylinder or just a...
Yeah.
Wow.
It was that. And there was an opera singer who sang in Europe at the same time, simultaneously, and she sang in India. And all the purists said, this can't be done. You can't sing 2.5 minutes of a rag. It's because a rag is like jazz. It's fully improv. There's 7 notes and you play with them as you will. So she said, why can't I do it in 2.5 minutes? I'll do it in 2.5 minutes. I'll do it in less than 2.5 minutes.
She's a great editor is what she was.
That
I don't need
too.
That. I don't need this.
And her life is fascinating because, she's historically very important. And I was just telling some of your colleagues outside that even my very good musicians who work with Zakir Hussain hadn't heard of her. And we discovered her because of the book. And then we Googled her and found that she'd sung all this wonderful music, which is still sung till today. And her personal story is very contemporary and very inspiring. You know, it was a story where she was so successful professionally and financially very rich. And yet, like most modern women, she had to juggle her personal life because if she wanted to excel at being an artist, she couldn't have it all. And she had all this string of lovers who fleeced her nicely and went off, and she died in penury.
Really?
So what's new?
we can talk about some Hollywood-Bollywood comparisons a little bit later with your career. But I mentioned that you...
So I discovered her through the book. Then I adapted the book into a play. And then we added the music because it wasn't written as a musical.
So it's your adaptation for the play?
Yes, with Mahesh Dattani.
Mahesh, who, as I mentioned earlier, wrote The Dance Like a Man.
Yes, he's written several plays for me, and he's an award-winning playwright from India and has been much acclaimed abroad. He teaches in many countries, including America. And he wrote it, and then we added the music. So we had to create the music. What you heard was music that I've created with a person who arranged and, you know, put it together for me. And it has live singing. So there are two Gauhars who sing in it. And you heard the younger Gauhar just now, who was singing like her. Because using her scratchy recordings was a bit of a disservice. It, you know, she didn't sound the way she must have sounded, magnificent when she when she actually sang. So we said, let's replicate her music. Let's not play the scratchy old recordings. And that's what we did. And so she's there in all her glory now, in a very clean sound, and you know, arranged by some very, very good musicians. And we used to have live musicians actually earlier, but we couldn't carry them to America, so we did a minus one recording.
So you must have done some. You must be channeling Gauhar in terms of adapting the book down to a screenplay. You're a very good editor in that.
You know, someone came and saw it. I was toying, we should do it into a film. It's such a magnificent theme, and a very big director came, saw it, said it's fabulous, and the next thing I knew, he'd bought the rights for it, and he's making it into this magnum opus now. Which is great in a way, because at least her story will be told. And the sad thing is that a lot of her music is used and there's no acknowledgement that it belonged to her. So that is a good thing that's going to happen.
What's interesting learning about her, too, is not only was she the first to ever record Indian music, but it was some 600 records in 10 more than 10 languages.
20 languages. She sang in 20 languages. And she was very unusual because in those days, you belonged to a school of music. It's called a gharana. So you were my guru and I came to you and I didn't go to anybody else. But she was fearless. she learned from everybody that she could learn from. And she said, I don't believe in all this. If he's good, he will teach me this. If he's good, he will teach me that. So I think that was one of her strengths, that she was a very, very thirsty artist who didn't care where she learned it from and enriched her repertoire by that.
Hmm.
So, and she was a very feisty woman, you know, very feisty. In those days, you weren't allowed to own a 6-horse carriage. We're talking, of course, when the Brits were there. And she had a carriage with 6 white horses.
Wow.
Okay? And she changed her dress, and she had the most fabulous jewelry. She changed her clothes every time she recorded the American engineer who went from the Gramophone Company of England, who was quite smitten by her because she was also stunningly beautiful. He couldn't get over it, you know, that every time she came, she looked like a diva in new clothes. But I'll give you an example to show her personality. So the Indians weren't allowed to drive around the central part of Calcutta because only the governor and people of a certain stature, even ordinary British resident, couldn't. So she used to take her carriage with her white horses and defiantly drive around the Victoria Memorial. And she was always hauled up. And in those days, the fine was 1,000 rupees, which is like, I don't know, $100,000 maybe.
Oh, gosh.
And she said, so what's the big deal? They said, well, you're not allowed to drive. You'll have to pay $1,000 every time you drive. She says, well, I'm paying you for today. And I think I'll pay you for tomorrow and day after as well. Just take it because I'm going to bring my cats for a ride tomorrow. She was delightful.
She was quite feisty. So are we going to hear some of those kind of anecdotes and stories of her life in this production?
Yes. It's very richly, meticulously researched. So we've really taken out all the gems that we could. And incorporated them into the story as well.
So how did Mahesh become involved with this character?
Well, Mahesh and I are like an old married couple, you know. we work together for
Your husband doesn't mind.
Luckily, Mahesh is gay. And so.
Well, maybe you should call me then.
Yeah, maybe. And we've known each other like 26 years and we worked on 5 productions together. You know, in India, it's very important for playwrights, new playwrights, to be supported because the state doesn't support them, government doesn't support them, and they will stop writing if they're not commissioned and if their work is not produced. And Mahesh is enormously talented. So this is our 5th production together. And so we know each other's ways. You know, I mean, if I do the red pencil, he doesn't cry. He used to cry in the beginning. Every O had to be there. Every E had to be there. So now I just slash, slash, slash. And I said, it's not working. I'm sorry.
You absolutely are channeling him. Absolutely are channeling Gauhar.
Yes. That's why I related to her, resonated with her. So he's good to work with because he has a good, dramaturgy. His dramaturgy is good. But it took a lot of time. We workshopped a lot. And that's what's exciting about doing work in India. It's not set. You're discovering, you're exploring. It's a process, creative process with 2 or 3 people. My new play is based on a short story by a very well-known popular writer. And I got a young guy in to adapt the story. And then I workshopped it with the actors. So it's not like I get a lovely, ready-made, perfect Eugene O'Neill play and I just put it out there on the boards. All I have to do is get good actors and direct it decently and I'm done. There's a lot more hard work.
A lot of sweat equity as well as equity actors.
Yeah, I'm not getting the equity. I'm just getting just developing sweat. So, but it's nice because we're building up a body of original Indian work. You see, the English theatre in India was very derivative. I don't see it in a bad way. I did it for 15 years myself. We were doing plays that were not written in India. So they were universal, they were very strong, but they didn't tell our stories. I always tell my friend Meera Nair that I did Dance Like a Man 6 years before Monsoon Wedding when we told our own stories in their own sort of ethos, social, cultural context, while being very, very accessible to Western audiences, non-Indian audiences. So when I did a play like Dance Like a Man, which we were talking about in New York off Broadway, the New York Times critic could completely relate to the play, even though it's set in the world of Indian classical dance. And we spoke with accents. We didn't speak even, you know, the proper British Queen's English, which I'm trying to speak just now.
you're doing great. speaking of how you're talking, are all of the productions that you're developing being developed solely in English?
Mostly in English. Why? Because I want to travel with them. One of the sort of the reasons for my setting up a theatre company was to do original work and to travel with it. So we have traveled from Wellington, New Zealand to Portland, Oregon, and to through most of the continents in between, and are the most widely traveled. And we could do that because we were telling Indian stories, but in English.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, because we don't have access to subtitling everywhere. So you have to understand the story, even though it may be slightly accented, it may have words that you don't understand. But we want you to enter this world, and we want you to try and understand things without putting them on a silver platter and saying, oh, this is a glossary. This means this. This means that. No. You figure it out when you come.
Nice.
So that's why it's in English.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Lilette Dubé, who's directing a production at Enact Arts on the life of Gauhar Jaan. Also with Vinita Bellani, who's been here to open air a couple times before. Happy to have her. And what a catch here, having Lilette. Goodness.
Yeah, I think Gauhar, I feel like her spirit came and said, you know, my story needs to be told. Vikram Sambath, who wrote the book, is an alumnus of the same university that I am from. We are both engineers, both called to the arts after a successful career in technology. And I say this because we sit in technology world, and to those people who are technology people but who have an artistic side, there is hope for you.
Well, we're going to have a geek on shortly to talk about some loser songs in the world of tech. So
all right.
There's hope for you, Will. You hear that?
Yay for geeks. So, somebody gave me the book and said, this is definitely something that Enact should do. And then, of course, I started researching it and I found that Lilette was doing it. And, you know, everything that Lilette talked about in her theater company, Primetime Theater, is saying all the same things that we've been saying. And so the ideas, the philosophy behind why we're doing theater, why we're doing it in English, why we're doing South Asian stories, is so sort of one-on-one mapped between Enact and Primetime. And I said, I don't need to do it. I just need to invite this extremely accomplished person to come and do it for us.
Make it easy for you.
Well, it's an honor for us, definitely.
Sure,
yes.
Sure. Lilette, you mentioned that this was workshopped in India. This was also performed just last week in Houston.
Yes.
Were you involved in that production? Were you able to see that production? Or
Yeah. We came on this tour. It's been done in London as well. We did 10 days in London. And it's going to Dubai and it's going to Hong Kong. So I like to travel a lot. I was just telling Vinita that my model is you do a play and then you, as my friends say, run the horse till it's dead. But I don't do that. I say the horse is running on its own. I'm not flogging it to run. But I think the model is to do as many shows as we can with the production. If we put in so much. So Houston was part of this tour. Presented by Enact. So we did three shows there, and then we're doing two shows here in the Bay Area.
Is there much of a South Asian community in Houston? Or
huge.
Yes,
huge,
very
really?
Huge. A very substantial, very articulate and knowledgeable community.
Fascinating.
And so many music schools, South Asian music schools, you know. Gauhar was, people loved it.
Uh-huh. Where else has this tour...
Just three standing ovations, that's all.
Oh, you can handle that.
Well, it's had 50, so we're okay. I think we're doing something right.
What are the other stops for this particular tour then?
For this one, this is it. We finish in the Bay Area and then we're back in Mumbai.
And the performances are at the Mexican Heritage Plaza in San Jose on Saturday, I believe.
Yes.
And then at Cumberley Theater in Palo Alto on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So, please.
Well, I'm just going to say there are still a few tickets available, very few. So anybody that's interested, get them quick.
I would go to Enact Arts, enact.org, ENACTE.org for tickets and more information about the production. Let's talk a little bit about Hollywood Bollywood, shall we?
I was wondering when that's coming.
Hollywood is all about stereotypes. Is it difficult for you to find roles in Hollywood versus Bollywood?
Well, Bollywood's exactly the same.
I would think.
You know, why one loves the theater, and my sort of soul has been sold to it, is because, really, the theater is one of the last few bastions left where an actor is king. He rules. Film is not like that. Film is a director's medium, completely, and it is ruled by commerce. Let there be no doubts about that. By commerce. By commerce, the bottom line. And I don't mean the bottom line, but I mean the bottom, financial bottom line. It's very much ruled by that. Even the small independent cinema, it starts like that, but if the producer doesn't recover his money, that director is never going to get a chance to make another independent film. So we have to be very clear. Well, theater, yes, the commercial Broadway, Western theater, of course, money is very, very important, recoveries, etc. But the kind of theater I do, yes, we have to make enough to keep, I have to have a financial model that I make money to do another production. And we don't get any help from the state. We don't get grants. Like a lot of Western countries do. We don't get any support from state, government, arts councils, zilch.
Why do you suppose that is?
Because we're a poor country. We need our money for many more important things, for infrastructure, for literacy, for feeding people. I mean, there's so many people below the poverty line. See, though art is so, so important, hyacinths for the soul, as Eliot said, it's a luxury. First, you have to feed your belly, and you have to have a place to sleep, and you have to feed your children, and then you can afford to enjoy.
You know what will help your country? A military parade.
We have that. Every year on the 26th of January, we have a lovely parade, a beautiful parade. And we spend and we spend oodles of taxpayers' money on that. So I don't think I can afford to give any more money for any more parades.
Nor should we.
Gay parades or military parades, no more parades.
I'm with you on that front, believe me. Now, please.
Yeah. So I was saying that we don't get any support from anybody. So we have to generate our own funds to keep doing this. And you were talking about film. So I was trying to tell you that for an actor, this is where you do the kind of themes as a director, producer that you want to do. My plays have talked about Zen Buddhism, you know, sexual abuse, homosexuality, things that were never seen on main stage. On the mainstream stages. So you're so free to talk about anything, Gandhi's philosophy, you know. These are not themes that a film would be interested in doing, because what would you earn back for something like this? Nothing. So it's the only place left where you can really do this kind of thing. And so I was coming to roles. And roles in cinema are very, very determined by your visual look. On stage, I can play 10-year-old, I can play a 92-year-old, and the suspension of disbelief is complete.
Right.
As long as it can convince you that I'm sitting on a balloon and I say I'm on the moon, you will believe me. But I can't do that in film. I have to look the correct thing. The visuals have to be correct. Everything has to be very realistic. We don't live in the imagination. We see reality as it is. So for me, it was so limiting. And I kept trying to jump out of drawers because they want to label you. Or you look like a strong, glamorous, dynamic woman. Now you will get only those roles.
Right.
Other roles. I don't want to keep doing the same roles.
Yeah.
So I want to jump out of that drawer. And they said, but you can't keep jumping drawers. You have to stay in that drawer. You've been labeled this. And now this is what you are. So it's the same in Bollywood. It's the same in Hollywood. I mean, I think Hollywood, frankly, has a lot more scope for, let's say, mature female actresses.
Who are also having problems finding roles as well. I mean,
But still, Meryl Streep gets fabulous parts. Helen Mirren gets fabulous parts. Look at Judi Dench and Maggie Smith. They were a delight to work with. They were 78 in the first Marigold. They were turning 80 in the second Marigold. And I remember telling Judy, she'd lost her husband about 13, 14 years before, you know, the film. And she'd keep SMSing somebody, you know, late in the night in India. And I said, come on, don't tell me you have a boyfriend. I hope it's a boyfriend. She said, yes, actually. And she giggled and she said, yes, it is a boyfriend. Then she told me how she's doing a new film with Dustin Hoffman straight after an HBO film. And then she told me how she'd got new knees in the second one. But she wanted to dance. She said, heck, I'm going to dance. I said, it's 2:30 in the morning. Why don't you go and sleep? She said, no. And she waited and she waited and she did the whole thing. And it was so funny because there was one move, which is a very typical Bollywood move, you know, quite sexy. Yeah. And she kept saying, "What was that move, darling? The one that where you were shampooing the dog?" I said, "I don't think the choreographer meant it quite like that, but that's how you get it." And I said, "Judy, I want to grow up to be Judy Dench. I want to have a new boyfriend at 80. I want to do a new film with Dustin Hoffman."
You know, someone as vibrant and attractive and wonderful as you right now, you almost want to jump to that age because the roles are becoming more...
better and better. I want to fast track.
Do you see something happening in Bollywood that has happened in Hollywood in terms of the scandals? Do you want to call anyone out right now?
Look, scandals are everywhere. And one thing I have realized that, you know, you hear stories and rumors and you think, oh, this can't be true. But 99.9% of times it is true. It is true. It's not that those things aren't happening. It's just that they just come out in the open. And but you know, I'm a funny maverick sort of an actress. I call myself an accidental film actress because I got into films in my 40s. I was very much a dyed-in-the-wool theater person, and I just stumbled into Bombay because my husband came to work with a very, very big industrialist who in his company, and somebody said, "Would you do this film for me? I'd be honored if you did it." I said, "I'd love to," because he's a magnificent director. And that's how it happened. And look back now in 15, 17 years, I've done like 55 films. And I don't know how, because I never really sought to do films. But the thing is that I think I was free because I didn't come with the baggage of a huge star. You know, when you've done some magnificent roles and somebody says, "Will you do this role in The Marigold?" You know, it's just 6, 7, 8 scenes. And if I've been a very big star, I would think twice that, you know, do I really want to do something as small as that? At least in Bollywood, it works like that. I see it doesn't work like that abroad because, for instance, Vanessa Redgrave has done 2 scene parts and so have some very good actresses. So as they get older, they're very mature. They understand they're not going to get those large heroine sort of roles. But the truth is that even Hollywood and Bollywood are very much ruled by the male actor, whether he's the supporting actor or whether he's the lead actor, and all of them at 55 are still romancing girls who are 25, but the reverse doesn't happen for women. So, you know, it's a very male-dominated industry. Bollywood, 101%, and even Hollywood, honestly, is.
Yeah.
The male star carries the movie. Be very clear about that. Mm. Not the female star.
Interesting.
She's very replaceable.
Mm. Unless you're Meryl Streep.
Unless you're Meryl Streep.
Yes. Well, you have the good fortune of working with your daughter on a project, too.
Yes. I worked with some of my daughters in films, in Monsoon Wedding with one who's now become a psychoanalyst. She finds acting too non-stimulating mentally. So I said, "Thank you very much. Just given 40 years to it." But what the hell?
I don't want to become like Mom.
So, but the younger one who went to Yale and did a theater major and all that is a full-time actress. I worked with her. And so I worked with both of them, actually. Been fun.
Nice. And I mentioned earlier that you're going to be giving a talk this afternoon at UC Berkeley. What's going to be the focus of that talk?
I'm figuring it out.
Okay. Well, you got 3.5 hours.
3.5 hours and a coffee. No, I'm joking. Of course, I have an idea.
That'll be at Stevens Hall this afternoon from 5 to 7, talk with Lillette Dubé. And of course, if you'd like to catch Gohar at down in San Jose or Palo Alto, very limited tickets are available. Go to enactarts.org for more information on that. We're going to hear more music from the production, a track called, maybe you can help us out with this, Krishna Ni?
Krishna Ni Began.
What is that all about?
It's she sang all kinds of music, different genres. So the first that you heard is a dadra. It's a sort of a semi-classical piece. This was what's a bhajan? So it's like a... it's like a spiritual song, you know. You know the Lord Krishna. He's one of our, you know, you must have seen all the Krishna sort of disciples, even in California, mm-hmm. who wear orange robes and, you know, they worship Krishna, our God. So it's a song dedicated to him.
Thank you so much for coming in, Lillette. And
my
of course,
pleasure.
Vanita, we'll see you again soon, I'm sure.
Oh, well, thank you. I will look forward to that.
From the production of Gower.
Yeah.
Still to come on Open Air, a conversation with Cameron Carpenter, an organist giving his concerts at SF Jazz this weekend on his international touring organ. And, well, actually, from the winner of Gawar John, we're going to go to a loser next. Stay with us.
Hanging in the bathroom at the biggest party of the fall. I could stay right here or disappear, and nobody'd even notice at all. I'm a creeper in a bathroom, 'cause my buddy kinda left me alone. But I'd rather fake pee than stand awkwardly or pretend to check a text on my phone. Everything felt fine when I was half of a pair. Now through no fault of mine, there's no other half there. Now I'm just Michael in the bathroom. Michael in the bathroom at a party. Forget how long it's been, I'm just Michael in the bathroom. Michael in the bathroom at the party. No, you can't come in. I'm waiting it out till it's time to leave. And picking at grout as I softly grieve. I'm just Michael, who you don't know. Michael flying solo. Michael in the bathroom by himself.
Michael in the bathroom by himself, sung by Will Roland in his Bay Area concert debut with his highly acclaimed show Loser Songs. Will is currently starring in the 2017 Tony Award-winning Best Musical, Dear Evan Hansen, which we'll talk about. The Brooklyn-based actor-singer originated the role of Jared Kleinman in the off-Broadway and Washington, D.C. runs of Dear Evan Hansen as well. And in this original cabaret piece, Loser Songs, it's aimed at teenagers and at the adults who try to understand them. Will tells the stories of nerds, mad scientists, awkward friends, robots, dorks, and second bananas through the geek anthems of musical theater, folk, and rock. Welcome, Will Roland, to Open Air.
Thanks for having me, David.
We're also joined by the other royalty here in the Bay Area, Marilyn Levinson, the genius behind Bay Area Cabaret. Welcome back to you, Marilyn.
Thank you.
Will, so how much of Loser Songs is autobiographical?
You know, very little of it, actually. Okay. Part of the sort of origin for this show is I said my nightmare cabaret is going to a theater where a somewhat successful 28-year-old tells me about his life. And so I wanted my show to be anything but that. So it's all sort of built around this narrative. We follow this character. His name is Loser, much in the tradition of Everyman and other morality plays. And he is, you know, he is like me in some ways, but he's definitely squarely not me.
Okay, that's good to know. 'Cause it sounds like, you know, you're far from a loser. You got the Broadway going on, helping pay off your NYU student loan, no doubt.
That was my Christmas gift to myself. Totally paid in full.
Nice. Marilyn, how did you think of having Will on the series?
Well, actually, a lot of people have asked that question. Bay Area Cabaret, as you know, has been around for 14 years. We typically produce artists that they could be, you know, Will's mother. And we occasionally do a BAC 2.0 type of an offering with Adam Pascal and Anthony Rapp, for instance, years ago. We've done the Bay Area Teen Idol vocal competition for a few years. And we had the Adam Jacobs and his sister Ariel in the fall. Doing more traditional cabaret material. But Will's show, and Will as a performer, is what really excites me and makes me believe in the future of cabaret. He was recommended to us by a cabaret icon, Sidney Meier of Don't Tell Mamas in New York. And we were both talking about the future of cabaret, sitting there
in his bar, and I looked up and I saw a poster of a geek with noodles dripping out of his mouth and his pocket protector top, and it looked like he had breasts or something. And I just, like, Sydney and I both just wanted to reach out, and we both looked at each other and said, "Loser songs, this is it."
We should mention that Will's wearing his NASA t-shirt.
Yeah, no, you never know when you're going to have your picture taken on the radio, so I wanted to be very, very sort of in character as much as possible.
Well, I love your list of on your website of people that inspired you.
It's all true.
Let me just say a few of them. Jerry Orbach, I can see
the
that.
Idol.
Steve Buscemi, Steve Wozniak, Bayard Rustin, Jimmy Stewart, the Hamburglar. Okay. interesting list you got going there, along with William Daniels and Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, I mean, they're all, you know, I think the things that I value as an artist and the things that I value as an actor, I sort of really love people who are kind of singular and inimitable. I would hate to be like a very sort of like hunky, handsome actor who felt sort of interchangeable with other hunky, handsome actors. And so a lot of those people are sort of, you say them and immediately you have like an association.
You're in no danger of that. But actually,
ouch.
what I talk to, I mean that in such a loving way. What I talked to Sydney about is that, and he told me about, is that you're not your typical 28-year-old actor that has no real self-consciousness and can't really edit the material that you're performing. I mean, you're in your spare time, you're also a show doctor, right? And you've done a lot of productions at
a little
Hoya
bit, yeah. I mean, a lot of what I do as an actor is all about developing new work. I work a lot with writers. I work a lot with directors. There would be too much to say that I show doctor their shows, but I like to think that, you know, a writer
help,
or director
guide them.
Yeah, well, that I, you know, they give me the material and I surprise them with how good they are. That's my best day at the office, so to
nice,
speak.
Nice. Did I glean from your website that you're in currently living in Park Slope?
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
Right near the hospital. Which is convenient if I were to get sick.
Sure. Well, yeah. I was on 41 St. Mark's Ave for
oh, yeah, a little
about
further
12
south,
years.
Closer to 9th Street.
Yeah.
Great spot. Great
Good
place
spot.
To be.
Yeah, it was lovely. And, I mean, Brooklyn is happening, as you well know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm very happy to be in the not-at-all-hip, very sort of sleepy, yuppie center of Brooklyn, you know, rather than up in Williamsburg or something like that.
So you mentioned, you know, that your personality's coming out, and it's something that is marketable, really.
Now, hopefully.
How long do you think you can keep the geeky, nerdy look going? Or are you going to go full Pee Wee Herman and make a full career out of it?
Oh, you know, I think one of the most important things to me is that I take this sort of stock character, this sort of geek, this sort of outsider, this weirdo, this loser, and I try really hard to make him as three-dimensional and sort of, you know, humanize him as much as possible. So, you know, this show is, you know, it follows this guy's whole life, and hopefully the sort of the themes that we talk about, the sort of feelings of being an outsider, the feelings of not being heard, the feelings of not being understood, feel universal, you know, even to people who would not consider themselves to be geeks or losers or nerds in any way. And I think it's also important that it's, you know, a lot of the story is about this man's young life, but I don't think that it is in any way exclusively a story for young people. I would hope that everyone could sort of sit down and I've got some really great songwriters whose material I've cannibalized for this piece.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think what the way that they write and the way that they turn lyrics especially, I hope that most people will find it very engaging.
So are you contributing some of the words and lyrics? Or?
I'm contributing the book content.
The book content, sure.
Yeah. The way that it's structured is I, Will Roland, serve as your narrator. And then when I am singing, I am sort of embodying the character of Loser who speaks through song.
Nice. Will Roland is at Bay Area Cabaret in the beautiful Venetian Room at the Fairmont Hotel this Sunday at 5 p.m. BayAreaCabaret.org for more information. Will, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having
Marilyn,
me.
Marilyn, of course, we always look forward to the presentations at Bay Area Cabaret.
Thank you.
Will, we're going to go out with another Loser song about trying to be cool.
Definitely.
Cigarette.
I'm gonna smoke a cigarette, 'cause I'm a rebel. Yeah, go
to Dwayne Reed and buy a whole freaking set. That's what they call them, right? And the clerk will ask me which ones I'm buying, and I'll say like I'm not even trying. Marlboro. Then I'll walk around on the street at night. Or wait, first I gotta buy a lighter too. But then, I'm gonna smoke that cigarette, 'cause I've got feelings, which apparently no one's noticed yet. But I'm pretty tortured, you guys. And I'll stand on the roof in a cloud of smoking, say my parents' marriage was just a joke, and they abused me, well, they tickled, but abused, sure. And my artist friends will say, your life's so rough, and all I'll do is take a puff and blow. God, if only, only I wasn't so goddamn freaking happy, well, then I'd be happy. The bad man is so hot, he makes the girls scream for their happy. That's what they call me, happy. That's what they call me, oh. They won't think I'm so mellow when my teeth are bright yellow. Finally I'll be who I thought I would be. 'Cause me, I am totally the sort of person who, if I wanted to, could smoke a cigarette. I'm just busy, okay? But soon I'm gonna smoke a bag, I bet. And I'll be British, too. Deal! Take a look at me, governor. I'm disappearing. Pretty soon the only thing that you'll be hearing is whatever it sounds like when someone is smoking. And awesome! Think I can take a chance, and maybe then I'll actually like myself when I get that cigarette.
Will Roland, loser trying to be cool, smoking a cigarette. He's at Bay Area Cabaret this Sunday at 5 o'clock. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air here on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. My next guest, organist Cameron Carpenter, is definitely an artist that thinks outside the box. And he's designed quite a box in the form of the International Touring Organ, with a special state-of-the-art speaker array that is used for his tours. So extensive, in fact, that there are two such speaker arrays, one that lives in Europe for his tours there, and one here for his American tours. He's the only organist who has been nominated for a Grammy, that for his 2013 solo CD, Revolutionary. He is committed to bringing the organ out of the church and into the ears of the people, and he does so with a flamboyance worthy of comparisons to Liberace, or more contemporarily, Billy Idol or David Bowie, designing his own costumes, including rhinestone bedazzled organ shoes, which are projected on big screens as part of the show, showcasing his amazing footwork on the pedals. He last appeared on Open Air back in 2013, interviewed by my colleague Sarah Cahill, when he was in town to provide live accompaniment to the Battleship Potemkin at Davies Symphony Hall. He appeared earlier this week at Stanford and is now at SF Jazz for four performances, tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 7:30 p.m., Sunday at 2 p.m. I caught up with him at SF Jazz, where we had a long-ranging conversation that, in fact, went on a bit too long for broadcast on today's show. The full interview will be posted at the Open Air webpage for today's show. Here's an abbreviated version of that conversation, edited by Temu Aton. A side note, this is a field recording, so you may also enjoy an occasional police siren or truck passing outside on Hay Street. Cameron, welcome back to Open Air.
Thanks for having me. Thank you for your interest.
You're here with your own international touring organ, an instrument I believe that you had a great deal of input in creating.
I designed it. It's both my chosen organ and also my statement about what the organ should be.
And I understand that you've sampled a lot of the great organs of the world to include as part of the sounds of that organ.
I wouldn't say of the great organs of the world. The organ is exclusively American. It's my position that the pipe organ reached its zenith in America, not in Europe. The fashionable kind of organ today is this sort of grossly eclectic, neo-Baroque pipe organ or whatever. That's not the instrument for me that's most fascinating, or indeed for me the most musical or practical. It's the early to mid-century, American school of organ building, and that's what I've emulated here. But all of the sounds from this instrument come from American organs. So there's no European sound in the instrument. It's made in America.
And as good as the acoustics and the sound system that you've employed here for the International Touring Organ, which I understand there's one here and there's one in Europe, I don't think anyone will confuse the acoustic with that of a great cavernous Notre Dame or Chartres.
No, but there's no reason that should be implicit in the expectation of any organ music. The inclusion of organs in cavernous acoustic spaces is incidental to the identity of the instrument itself. That's not to say that it isn't an enormously contributive factor. There's a great organ here in town at Grace Cathedral, but our idea that the organ can only be understood in the context of giant naves and domes is absurd. The organ is an instrument of architecture as well as of music.
I have to ask you about the actual sounds that will be coming from the organ. You mentioned that they're uniquely American organ sounds. Are they only organ sounds, or are there also electronic sounds that you've incorporated, rather like a synthesizer?
No, there's no synthesis in the instrument, though it's, of course, MIDI-capable. We don't employ any MIDI technology. We don't connect any outboard synthesizers or anything like that. It would be very easy to assemble some sort of mishmash composite instrument that pulled sounds and from all sorts of different origins. But actually, that's not my focus at all. My focus here was to use the technology that's available to us to build an organ in the traditional form.
Have you played on any of the other institutional organs of San Francisco, and do you have a favorite?
Well, no. My organ is my favorite, and as it should be. SF Jazz presented me at Grace Cathedral several years ago, and I had a long-standing relationship with the San Francisco Symphony, and I've played at Davies Hall many times. And actually, the Davies Hall organ, in that I began that relationship, and first played my first recital around the time that I started playing my first recitals at Disney Hall, too. That was before I moved to Berlin, Germany, so that was like in 2006, 7, 8. So, my entree into getting to play in San Francisco was Davies Hall. So that's a place that's quite special to me. And the Castro Theater, of course, is another institutional organ in town with which I'm familiar, and one that's quite dear to me in the sense that it's another place where there, all too rarely, I'm sorry to say, where the institution and the organist and the powers that be have heavily backed the concept of the digital organ and are completely reinventing a historical instrument with the use of modern technology, which is exactly what they should do. And they're creating the world's largest theater organ there. So that's, that's a place that San Franciscans should know about and support, because it's a place where organ building is taking place not with broad thumbs and creased foreheads and ancient practices, but with actually modern and new attempts to redefine what an organ is. Both have to coexist.
You did mention that Berlin is now your home. You were raised in Pennsylvania, educated in, among other places, North Carolina and the Juilliard School. Why do you make Berlin your home now?
Well, I'm... lived in New York for 10 years, and then it became time to make a change. And that when I moved there, it was in 2010. It was the great realization that was dawning on me was that to fulfill any of the to even try to fulfill my ambitions for my career and my life, I needed to have my own instrument, and also a deep realization that I had access to And the conviction to regard the digital organ as the absolute superior in organ building.
That's great. We talked about your sense of design and that went into the creation of this organ and with other organs as well. Your sense of design extends to your trademark, which is a certain degree of showmanship and costumery, which you also are designing. You're also designing your own special shoes for using all the pedals. So where do you see this going? You're in your 30s now. Do you see this happening for another 20 years? Would you want to become institutionalized like a Liberace in Vegas? But when you think of
quite
the millions...
to be institutionalized in some way or another.
But I mean, Liberace brought the piano music that no one had heard to millions of people. Do you want to be that sort of person that does that for
work? Liberace brought the piano music that everyone had heard to millions of people in a different way. And you see... That's a lot of different questions. What I see myself doing, the implications of how that might open the door to a discussion of Liberace is sort of a third subject in the room. But one thing at a time. I mean, first of all, no, I don't regard anything that I'm doing as sustainable, not in the remotest possibility. I think partly because of the absurd and silly film which was very stupidly released by Sony Classical with my first album, and of course in which I was, let's face it, somewhat complicit.
What was that?
It was a silly little film called The Sound of My Life, which now you've made me mention, but which no one should ever watch, and which was deservedly mocked online, including by yours truly. And a gross misportrayal that did a lot of damage. If you look at that movie, then you get the impression that I must be independently wealthy, and that I'm actually rather a dilettante. But in fact, this organ is my singular obsession. I lose a lot of money on it, and despite the fact that I'm one of those classical musicians still who is actually shockingly well paid, I don't make that much money at the end of the day because the instrument's so damned expensive.
And you have two of them to maintain.
Well, I have one organ, but two systems, two sound systems. By the way, please understand, I'm not complaining. It's my choice, and my problems, as always, are of my own creation. But I don't regard. I've never. You can go back at older interviews and look at this too. I've always said the same thing. I never have imagined it possible for me to be one of these old men of the organ, and nor would I desire it. I love classical music. I've spent my whole life with it, and it's given me a great life. But it is also intense and grueling work, and don't ever be told that it isn't. I mean, I have every respect for my colleagues who seem to surround themselves with classical music for 24 hours a day, but I could never stand to. Classical music for me belongs at work, and it should be left at work. And that's true of the organ, too, in the sense that, you know, it's an instrument which requires maximum participation. It's a 24-hour, you know, it's a lifelong lifelong work. It's a craft. You don't play the organ and, you know, you may learn the organ and then later leave it behind, but you may not be free of it.
Well, I think the great builders of yore are smiling down on you wherever they may be.
You know, if they're smiling down, then they might just as well be, as George Carlin pointed, screaming up at us. I don't believe in either, and I'm not interested either, because I don't have to be. I don't need E.M. Skinner to be smiling down on me, because I have the sounds of his stops in my organ, and I can do what I want with them. And the brain trust that he has given us, and that Robert Hope Jones gave us in giving us the Wurlitzer organ, and in it, which Henry Willis gave us in giving us the high-pressure reeds which were developed by Skinner, and which Cavaille Cole gave us by giving us the first mechanical iteration of an organ which could actually hold a candle to the orchestral developments that we see in the music of Hector Berlioz. You know, the brain trust that those composers and organ builders leave us behind is part of our humanities collectively. Just as the works of J.S. Bach are not these... in these unassailable holy texts, you know, the work, the organ music of J.S. Bach belongs to everyone. To think that this music can be damaged or invalidated by an approach like mine, or a creative reinterpretation which allows the performer to express themselves through the music is completely ridiculous. The greatness and the permanence and the validity of these works is proven by their malleability and by their ability to submit to and prove or disprove different the claims we make upon them as interpreters. And actually that extends to the figures of old. I see no evidence at all that J.S. Bach would do anything except completely object to my playing. But the fact is that it doesn't matter, because if Bach were to walk in this room right now, reconstituted by the facilities out at SpaceX or whatever, and tell me that you know that he felt that everything that I was doing with his music was completely wrong, it would absolve me. There would not be an issue. It would not change the fact that I have the unalienable right. I have the inalienable right to interpret those works as I see fit without his permission. And that's true for all music and for all musicians, just as it is true that the building of a pipe organ in a public space is not a matter of ownership for the owner of the instrument. It is, if the pipe organ is the king of instruments, as we're constantly told, if the pipe organ is, as the organ community constantly tells us, worthy of preservation, worthy of the concern in which we invest, with which we invest its future and all of these things, then it would also have to follow that the intellectual material represented by the sounds not only of an organ but of all organs also belong to all of us and also should be continually reused in new and different ways. And that is exactly what the digital organ can do.
These concerts will primarily be focusing on the music of Johann Sebastian Bach.
That's what I'm told, yes.
And to coinciding with recent release, All You Need Is Bach, your CD, what else will we hear on these SF Jazz performances?
I'm hoping to play some music by Vaughan Williams, possibly Leonard Bernstein. There may be music by César Franck, and I'll probably improvise for good or ill.
Well, I'm sure it'll be for good for everyone. You pride yourself on being very accessible to your audiences, not an unusual thing, and to meet and greet. But what I think is unusual, and I think actually good marketing and creates a good connection with the audience, is to do this before the concert rather than after.
Well, it depends on the venue and it depends on the place of the place. It depends on the structure of the place and of the day and so on. But I mean... when you play the organ, you, after all, are generally confronted with people who are walking away. After all, what is the great solo moment of any church organist's Sunday? It's the postlude. The moment at which the organist gets to make their statement is also the moment at which they realize that they're playing for people who would rather go have coffee with people they hate than to listen to their work.
A portion of my interview with Cameron Carpenter. The full interview will be posted at klw.org for the open air webpage for today. He's at SF Jazz over these next four performances tonight, tomorrow, Saturday at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 2. We have two pairs of tickets for tonight's performance at SF Jazz, 7:30, 415-841-4134 for those tickets to Cameron Carpenter at SF Jazz, 415-841-4134. My thanks to Temu Atone for editing down that interview. Again, the full interview will be at klw.org and the open air webpage. Thanks also to Neil Swinkles for producing today's show. I'm David LaTulipe. If you've got a show segment suggestion, by all means, send me an email, david@klw.org. And again, our shows are archived at our website, klw.org. For tickets to tonight's Cameron Carpenter organ presentation concert extravaganza at SF Jazz, 415-841-4134. Thanks for listening to Open Air. An hour of news from the BBC is coming up next after these NPR headlines.